For years, the Bad River Band tribe in northwestern Wisconsin has been fighting a Canadian oil company over easements permitting the Line 5 pipeline to operate on reservation land in the state. A new documentary, Bad River, features interviews with dozens of Bad River Band members and tribal leaders to tell the story of the land and its people and their resistance to Line 5. By one measure, the Line 5 battle started when a contract ran out in 2013, but in so many other ways, this battle is centuries old. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seawart. Our guest today is here to speak about the new documentary, Bad River. It is narrated by Quanah Chasing Horse and Academy Award nominee Edward Norton. The film is playing in select AMC theaters and communities throughout the region, including in Shawano, Woodruff, Ashland, Hayward, Rothschild, and Stevens Point. Mary Mazzio is the director of the documentary. Mary, welcome to Route 51.
Thank you, Shereen. Thank you for having me. Delighted to be here.
Well, I want to start by talking a little bit about you and finding more out about you personally and how you got into filmmaking and making this film in particular.
Oh, thank you for that. Well, it starts yesterday. So I had been an athlete and a pretty serious athlete. And, you know, typically when you're training really hard, so I was on the Olympic team, in the gear up for that, you're supposed to sort of be napping, you know, you're training three times a day. You're supposed to be napping or resting. Well, I was writing in between our training sessions.
Oh my
and
goodness.
I was really writing about, women that I did not see reflected in our media culture. Right. So I had gone to an all women's college and I was like, all right, where are the smart women? Where are the heavy thighed women? Where are the right, like, and so I started writing screenplays and they, funny enough, began bouncing around Hollywood and I was having these meetings and, you know, it's amazing. You go to a town like Hollywood and everybody smiles and they tell you how talented you are. The second you leave the office, they're probably deep sixing your script, right?
Sure.
But anyways, I sort of came to this realization and I thought I would make feature films, right? I would write and direct and have a cool chair with my last name on it. And like, I don't smoke, but you know, fake smoke and
yeah.
have a shiny leather jacket and, you know, right out of the Matrix. And that just simply didn't happen. And so I was in film school, like completely on the sly. I was a young lawyer. And I would take my lunch breaks, right? And I was learning how to make films. And I ended up making a short film. It was a short documentary film. And everyone in the class was like, wow, that's really something. And when it came to graduate, I put in air quotes, from film school. I remember my husband said, well, you have to make a thesis film. How much is that going to cost? Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, I don't know, $5,000. Little did I know, right? $5,000. He's like, if we're going to spend money, like, what if you make it a real documentary and not just sort of a fake, you know, exercise? And that piece of advice from my husband, like, launched my career because I ended up making a real documentary. And that was an extraordinary story about gender equity. It was sort of encased in this great athletic story. It was called A Hero for Daisy. And that went off like a bomb. And, you know, Sunday New York Times, half a page, it's like lightning strikes, right?
Wow.
And that little film enabled me to move away from my day job, which was being a young lawyer. And I reopened our doors shortly after that. And that's, oh my God, 20 years ago.
Wow.
And that really sort of catapulted what would become sort of for me just this extraordinary opportunity to dive into stories that oftentimes you don't hear. And what's emblematic, I think, of all of our work and lessons that I learned early on, you know, this first film was, could have been like this, it was a go girl kind of film, you know, it could have been an unbelievable feminist polemic. And something inside me said, you know what? I think I want this film to appeal to like a broader range of people, and instinctively just held back a little bit. And what became amazing is some of the biggest proponents, of course, after the film came out were men. Really? Whether they worked at ESPN, where we ultimately, right, had a distribution deal, whether they were fathers, brothers, sons. And all of our work from then on has really been all about the human issue and a place where the left and the right can come together. And so that has really been the hallmark of so much that we do, is how can you articulate something where people that may disagree on a whole host of issues can come together and maybe help solve a problem. So fast forward to Bad River. I had been working on a film. It was an amazing story out of the west side of Chicago. And one of my partners on that film, Grant Hill, NBA great. I said, Grant, you know, I think it could be an extraordinary time to find a story from a tribal community. Mm-hmm. And the impetus for that was a call just after I make my, you know, my, I'm not going to make a fake documentary, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to make a real documentary, that went from zero to 60. I had gotten a call from a coach from the Navajo Reservation in Tuba City, Arizona. And he said, Mary, I have the most extraordinarily talented girls. I can't get a single one of them recruited to a D1 school, right? Because they're native athletes.
Wow.
And what do you think of that kind of story? And would you ever? And I remember thinking, wow, what a story.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was so early in my career, didn't easily find funding, but that conversation never left me.
Mm-hmm.
And it rattled, you know, some things do, right?
Sure.
And after the film that I worked on with Grant Hill, a story coming out of the west side of Chicago, that really, that project blew up in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, right? Mm-hmm. That's when I said to Grant, hey, what do you think? And ultimately, it was a chance meeting with the former chairman of the Bad River Band, Mike Wiggins.
Mm-hmm.
And this was while COVID was in full swing. We were still launching my film called The Most Beautiful Thing. And he said, hey, when COVID subsides, like, why don't you come to the reservation? And we'll do some canoe diplomacy. I'll never forget canoe diplomacy. Yeah. And I had no idea, Shireen, what that was. But I was like, okay, this sounds amazing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. And here we go. And I went and visited the reservation. The chairman took me, maybe spent the better part of 2 days, really showing me the topography, Lake Superior itself. And thus began sort of an extraordinary learning journey as someone who is not native, but also not native to the area either, right? Mm-hmm. And so this began just an extraordinary journey in so many ways of our new project, Bad River.
Being not native and not native to the area, do you feel like that gave you perhaps an edge because you were able to have this completely neutral view of what was happening?
I think what it did was, it was twofold, because able to examine a legal story, right? Like originally this was going to focus on the challenges that the Bad River Band had with an aging oil pipeline, mm-hmm. right? It transverses the heart of the reservation. And it wasn't until I began pre-interviewing, visiting with elders in the community. And that transformed the project completely. It took us in a 90 degree, you know, like, whoop, let's take a left-hand turn. Because while the elders wanted to sort of share their perspective on this pipeline challenge for the community, they also wanted to talk about, well, wait a minute, do you know what happened when there was going to be an open pit mine installed in the Pinokies? No, what happened there? And then the conversation with various tribal members was, hey, Running Horse Livingston kept saying, you know, my Uncle Clyde. Well, my Uncle Clyde, I'm like, wait, your Uncle Clyde? Like Clyde Bellecourt, as in one of the founders of the American Indian movement? Mm-hmm. Wait, what?
What?
Absolutely. stories were tumbling out, and they were stories of resilience and resistance, and how they themselves, their parents, their grandparents, their great grandparents, or their ancestors stood up and fought back and spoke out in a variety of different ways. And so this film really morphed into a historical retrospective, because that's what the elders wanted to, that's where they wanted this movie to go. Mm-hmm. And that's where the movie went. I think the other piece that's really fascinating as we come to the contemporary, I don't think you can understand the contemporary struggle without understanding the historical struggle. And that was the gift of the Bad River elders, right? Was they knew that people needed to understand the historical fight for land and culture before you can even begin to appreciate what is now a postage stamp of land, right? From millions and millions and millions and millions of acres, and how hard they are fighting this small tribal community with extraordinary effort to protect Lake Superior, and doing so not for themselves, but for all of us. And for me as a non-native, that lesson of long-term thinking, of selflessness, is one that, you know, we live in a culture where it's like, Amazon, I want it yesterday. Mm-hmm. Or
right, right.
This, where's that? It needs to happen this very second. And me, and I, and I'm a rugged individual, and I'm pulling myself up by the bootstraps. And it's not, and ultimately as an athlete, it's team. Right? It's all of us in this great sort of, you know, experience of life, being in something together. We're at a time where we're all being pulled apart by the seams, right? We've got our social fabric is fraying. And here is a community that is protecting an asset for all of us, for all Americans, in a way that is just an extraordinary act of selflessness. And so I think for me, being non-native, I was acutely struck by that.
I just as an aside, I have to know, what sport were you an athlete in?
Rowing.
Oh, you are a rower. Okay, wonderful. Yeah, and it just kept rattling around in my brain. Now I have to know. I also have to know, what is canoe diplomacy? Because I don't know what that is either.
I didn't either. And yeah. I wasn't sure what it meant. And to this day, I should ask Mike Wiggins what that meant. But I think it meant, you know what, you, and he didn't explicitly say this, and I didn't fully understand it, but to be non-native and to show up in a tribal community, I think he was like, you know, let's kind of just see how this goes.
Mm-hmm.
And he was not auspicious, because, you know, even with Mike, he is showing me sort of the waterways, and he's showing me, you know, the pristine beaches, and we, you know, the Bad River itself, she turns right into Lake Superior. And mm-hmm. it's sort of this amazing transformation, both physically and metaphysically. And we pull up on a beach and we get out of the boat, and I see this small shiny rock, right? And what do I do? I reach down and I'm like, oh, are we profanity free here?
You can say that. That's okay.
I was like, oh no. And I knew those moments of extreme embarrassment, like mortified by myself. And I'm like, oh my God. Mm-hmm. And Mike, like without losing a beat, he said, all right, let me see what you have in your hands. I opened my hand and he said, okay, it's not a grandfather rock, which we hold to be sacred.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, please let me put it back. I wasn't thinking, I'm so sorry. That just was so insensitive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he put down some tobacco and he said that this is an act of gratitude. You may now keep that rock.
Oh.
For me, right, that was one of many, many lessons that, you know, that we have been so inculcated with this idea of individual, of self, self-aggrandizement, self-improvement, that to understand both in a small way, in a large way, what it means to be part of this kind of community. It is, I think it's an antidote for how do we come back together? How do we think in a long-term fashion, not quarterly, not daily? And how do we get back to who we are supposed to be?
Mary Mazzio is our guest today on Route 51. We're discussing the documentary Bad River, which chronicles the tribal band's fight against the Enbridge pipeline and so much more. We'll pick up the conversation in just a moment. I'm Shereen Siewer. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Back on Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Shereen Seward, along with our guest, Mary Mazzio. We're having a discussion about the new documentary, Bad River, which details the controversy between Enbridge and the tribal band in Wisconsin and chronicles a history that led to this ongoing conflict. I watched the movie last night, and I watched it with my husband, my sister, my adult son, and they're like, all right, yeah, what's it about? And I said, well, it's about the Enbridge thing. And so we all sat down, and but in fact, it's about so much more. I mean, so as serious as the conflict is with Enbridge, it felt that this was just a very small part of what you documented in the film. And you touched on that just a few minutes ago, talking about how it was really important to understand the history. And you start early in the film about allotment land and how parcels were divided by the federal government. Can you talk about that a little bit and why it's so central to all of this?
Great question, Shereen. And one that my co-producer, Allison Abner, Allison wrote for Narcos and West Wing. She hails from the Stockbridge Muncie band. And she said, you know, Mary, in order for people to understand this, this is a story about land. And all of us can relate to our relationship with land. And she said, I think we have to dive into the Dawes Act and how Native communities were completely dispossessed, you know, by the mechanism of the federal government from their land. And that has been institutionalized both from a governance and a legal standpoint, right? And you see Native communities all over the country fighting for what was rightfully theirs, particularly according to all of the treaties that had been signed back typically in the 1800s. But in any event, Allison said, so I think we need to include the Dawes Act. And I was like, Dawes Act, Schmaz Act, like that, everybody's going to fall asleep. And you know what? She was right, because even, you know, we touch upon it, right? And this is really an impressionistic painting in many ways of Native history in this country. It's so important that the viewer is grounded in what actually happened to Native people and their land, so that when you come to the current and contemporary story, it's a new chapter of a very old story of taking.
And the treaties relinquished some territories and retain perpetual rights to hunt and fish and gather. But the treaties are really just one of the formal ways that the U.S. federal government gained access to Native lands. And it struck me while watching the film as survivors and their descendants were discussing federal legislation that sought to remove the people from their land and assimilate them into white American culture. Talk about that and what the people in the film shared with you and how powerful that was.
So the stories, particularly from the elders, of how their parents and great-grandparents really resisted this assimilatory pressure, right? Which was, you know, you take the boarding schools where young Native children were shipped away to boarding school. And these weren't the boarding schools that we think of in a contemporary way, right? They were military institutions, carceral institutions. They all had prisons. And children as young as 4 and 5 and 6 were picked up and shipped off. And oftentimes there was a black, as elders described, there would be a black car that would come driving down the reservation and grab children. And okay, all of a sudden they're shipped, you know, hundreds of miles away. And And many of us grow up in this country with no knowledge of this sort of history. I think there were so many lessons that the elders spoke to and how they resisted various forms of this kind of assimilatory pressure. And certainly coming out of the boarding schools, you have all kinds of children dying in a variety of different ways and causes coming out of this boarding school. It was a crisis, really. It was as inhumane as you can possibly think of, right? You are cutting off ties with their parents. Many of these children could not communicate with their parents when they got back because their parents did not speak English. And they could not recall their original language. The stories that these elders shared of that, of relocation in the 1950s, when urban people were set, when Native people were pushed into urban areas, it was effectively a refugee crisis. Whenever you displace large groups of people, the outcomes are not good, right? You've got children in the balance, you've got women, that are really acutely prone to being trafficked, right, in any kind of refugee crisis. And so you see a variety of different ways over centuries of how, the dominant culture, I put in air quotes, the dominant culture was trying to figure out how to subjugate, really, this original culture, right, that was here. And by the way, avail themselves of the land. And so we all grow up learning, and not in any deep way, but we all understand the story of slavery and human trafficking. But what it the corollary is, well, you've got, as one scholar says in the film, to understand stolen labor, you also have to understand stolen land. And what does that mean?
Sure. One of the people you spoke to, Syracuse University professor Dr. Scott Manning Stevens, had some, really interesting perspectives to share. And one thing that stuck out was talking about that period of time from the 40s to the 60s when the federal government ended its treaty obligations with a lot of tribes, something like 100 tribes or whatever the number is, terminating their contracts. And he referred to this, I made a note, as a genocidal project. He called that a genocidal project. What do you think he meant by that? I mean, what was your reaction to that?
I think, he was really speaking to the relocation era, which went hand in hand with termination in the 50s. That was, of course, on top of boarding schools. And that idea that it was intended to kill Native people spiritually, culturally, almost in every way. And then, of course, we have a sister from the Franciscan order of nuns come on screen, and she spoke to the church's complicity in what she called cultural genocide. That's a really strong phrase. And she used that phrase, and that was really a stunning admission to, yes, what we did was actually harmful. And we are starting this process of reconciliation, of truth telling, of truth finding. But that she could so forcefully articulate the damaging effects of that, I thought was pretty stunning.
It certainly was. It was one of those moments in the film where, your jaw drops at all of it. There was one segment in the film that goes over some additional history. And I know people who lived in the Rhineland or Tomahawk Park Falls area will remember this back from the late 80s and early 90s. And I was living in Rhinelander during that time. So I do remember my friends being involved in some of this stuff, the Walleye Wars. And you include this in here. So talk a little bit about the Walleye Wars and why this relates to what we're seeing today.
Thank you for that question. I think there's been a fundamental misunderstanding of what Native people were fighting for so hard in the 70s and the 80s. And that was, they had granted the United States government what they believed was co-use of millions and millions and millions of acres. And for the Lake Superior Ojibwe, of course, that was most of Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, right? Shall I go on? Right? Millions of acres. And they said, in exchange for this huge ability for you to timber and forest and use co-use this land. They were not giving up the land insofar as they understood it. We want to retain the right to hunt, fish, and gather, because that is how we survive. And that those rights to hunt, fish, and gather were routinely, run roughshod, right, by the state of Wisconsin, for example, that would say, okay, you've got certain fishing limits. And it took some early lawsuits, of course, by a Bad River member, among others. The Tribble brothers, of course, famously brought suit that went up to the Seventh Circuit. And that was, do we have the right to hunt, fish, and gather for our families, irrespective of any kind of state imposition or state limits? And of course, the court found in their favor. And without a full explanation or a history, right, of how these treaty rights had been granted from the get-go, I think there was a lot of misunderstanding, particularly by sports fishermen and fisherwomen, who really approached this with like, well, this doesn't seem fair. And as scholar Anton Troyer said to me at one point during his interview, he said the state of Wisconsin, when they articulated the bag limits for sports fishermen, really threw gas on the fire by saying, we are enforcing these, we're posting these bag limits, these catch limits, because Native people have expanded rights. Or they said something completely inflammatory that just lit this cocktail of anger and resentment. And, when you hear the perspective from Bad River members describe, and many of the people who were fighting for their rights served in the Navy from Bad River, served in the Army, served our military, were patriots and citizens themselves, I think it was very, very painful for them to witness a group of people with the American flag waving, saying, go home, and really uncharitable comments, right, that were lobbed at Native fishermen. And the other piece to this is the fundamental misunderstanding of how Native peoples actually maintain and fish and keep these rights, which is, we don't fish to extinction. Mm-hmm. We fish in moderation. Not only that, but we now collect eggs, we have a hatchery, and we actually cultivate and release for everyone in this Lake Superior area far more fingerlings and fish than we ever take out. And I think all of this was lost in this sort of powder keg of misunderstanding. And that goes on today. I mean, there are Bad River members that that recounted stories where they heard, rifles. And again, I think it stems from this lack of history that all of us who are non-Native, we simply don't know. We're completely unaware, and myself included.
Sure. And I will admit to that as well. I didn't understand that conflict back then. And when I heard one gentleman in the movie saying, he was talking about this whole issue, and he said, you have no clue about who we are, our beliefs, our culture. I mean, there was a lot of confusion. I mean, this, it feels like perhaps this could have been handled a whole lot differently. In retrospect now, when you hear all of these different points of view.
Chaz Connors, who's in the movie, emailed me. He was in a supermarket in Ashland. Man comes up to him, says, I saw you in that movie. I need to shake your hand. It was really powerful. Chaz says, okay, I'll shake your hand. And you know what the man said? I'm so sorry. We just didn't know.
Wow.
I'm so sorry. We just didn't know. And, we're hearing that school districts are taking their children to go see Bad River. That's a beautiful thing, right? So that these children can begin to understand some of the origins of these rights, some of the origins of their own land, right? That they have courtesy of Native people, and give them a fuller understanding so that as they grow up and mature, they'll be much more informed than we were growing up, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's been sort of an exciting offshoot. And I think, as painful as some of these chapters are, the key takeaway is how inspirational, right, I think, These stories are in terms of every chapter has someone talking about their parent, their great grandparent, themselves, and how they stood up and fought back, or what they had to say, and whether it was, I am going to pray to my ancestors and bring out the drum in the middle of these, you know, sort of walleye protests, it's really remarkable and exciting to see a group of people, again, with that long-term view, right? This is for our future, for our future's future, for our seventh generation. This is also, we're putting in more fish than we take out. This is for you, your seventh generation. This is for all of us. And that theme of selflessness kind of continues to come over and over in waves, right? As we sort of explore each story. And I think if that sort of understanding had been better communicated back then or understood, people might have thought very, very differently, right?
Yeah, sure. Well, speaking of difficult chapters, you also go into the opioid epidemic in the movie. Why did you feel that that was important to include in Bad River?
I think, thank you for that question. For two reasons, really. The generational trauma of assimilation, of robbing of culture, land, and personhood, that has an impact today. And it's profound and profoundly sad. However, when you have people that are studying Ojibwe ceremony, Ojibwe cultural customs, and you hear from people who are recovering that are able to recover because of that connection with their culture, with their heritage, there's a beautiful fullness in that. And that was something when someone, you know, begins to learn their language, understand ceremony, there's a deep and profound connection to the past in a way that is, again, the greater collective. And that, I think, is just extraordinary.
You're listening to Mary Mazzio on Route 51. We're discussing the documentary Bad River, which features dozens of interviews with tribal members and officials who discuss the fight between the band and Enbridge Line 5 and the history of the tribe's fight for cultural survival as well. More ahead, I'm Shereen Seewert. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Back on Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Shereen Seward, along with our guest, Mary Mazzio, about the new documentary Bad River, which details the fight against Enbridge and the band's sovereignty and culture. Our guest stays with us for the hour. We've spent a lot of time now talking about everything that's in the film that leads up to this whole conflict, but we really need to talk about Line 5. So let's talk about Line 5, how it was planned many years ago, and I mean, how did this all begin?
So Line 5 was installed, interestingly enough, it was a way to transport oil from Western Canada to Eastern Canada. And the reason the pipeline, which was Line 1 at the time, came down through the Great Lakes and into the United States was because it was cheaper, it was easier from a permitting standpoint, and you had more forgiving terrain. And when you look at some of the, I actually went and looked at some of the old corporate documents from the Interprovincial Pipeline Company, which was the predecessor to Enbridge. It's very clear why they came down to the United States. It was easier and cheaper to move Canadian oil for Canadian citizens from west to east.
Okay.
And of course, when Line 5 was constructed, it was effectively rubber stamped by the Bureau of Indian Affairs in the United States for pennies for that company to run its pipeline through the heart of the reservation through 12 miles of Bad River land.
Did the tribe have any say in that at that time?
There was no consent, no evidence of consent. And in fact, if you look at 1953, what was happening? You had the move to terminate tribal status. You had tribal citizens being relocated off their land, and this opened up huge swaths of tribal land for pipelines, mines, and dams. And you see the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which did not have much tribal representation back then in the 50s, effectively, according to scholars, rubber stamping, yes, you can run that pipeline, that mine, that dam, no problem. It's either free or maybe it's a few cents.
Wow. And then there were a series of easement agreements over the years between the tribe and Enbridge. So talk about that a little bit. Like, when did they go into effect? And then the latest one expired more than a decade ago. Yes?
Yes. Yeah, so effectively, the first 20 years of the easement, the company was able to utilize the land, let's call it rent-free. There's no evidence that there were a few thousand dollars paid for 12 miles over 20 years. That's it. No evidence that that money ever made its way back to the Bad River Band. The BIA rubber stamped it again in the 1970s. No material payment again to the Bad River Band. So at this point in time, you have an energy giant utilizing this property for 40 years for basically close to zero, right? Really no material financial compensation. In the 1990s, the band was facing a financial crisis. This was a time when there was a shift in federal policy, right, which came after Nixon. And so the BIA now had a policy where in order to continue utilizing native land, you actually had to get the band's consent. And at that point, and that was 1992, the band said, the pipeline's here, it's operating quietly, like we don't see any problems. We're going to allow you on tribal land on 3 miles to operate for 50 years for $800,000. And then on the allotted lands, you would ask why we included the Dawes Act, right?
Yes.
So that people can understand. And then on allotted lands that were owned by Bad River members, the maximum that the term could be would be 20 years. And Enbridge paid some smaller, much smaller amount for the right to operate on 20 years. And of course, agreed that at the end of that 20-year period, that the pipeline would be removed and the land would be restored to its original condition. Those easements along allotted lands, which are 3 miles in length, which is quite significant, a 3 mile tranche expired in 2013. So that's 11 years ago. And the band at that point in time, Kalamazoo had happened. So there was an epic oil spill in Kalamazoo in 2010. And this was a $1.2 billion cleanup. And that was Enbridge Line 6A and 6B. And I think when that was in 2010, the rights expired in 2013. And as Bad River Band members recall, Enbridge had just started coming on the reservation and saying, wait, we got to check this. Wait, we have to check that. There's an anomaly. What's an anomaly? Right? There's a problem. There's an issue. And without full transparency, according to tribal members, you know, they kept hearing from Enbridge. And then they're looking over to what happened in Kalamazoo. And they said, wait, what's under our feet? How old is this pipeline? How do we know it's safe? And thus began a series of steps that I think the Bad River Band tried to seek resolution. Some members remember early requests for additional shutoff valves. Mm-hmm. What happens if we have a flood? And long story short, did not feel comfortable with either the response it got or the response that it didn't get, and decided, you know what, we're not going to consent to the renewal of this lease over 3 miles of allotted lands.
What was Enbridge's response to concerns about a potential pipeline rupture? Or, I mean, have they said they have a plan to prevent it? Have they said how they will address mitigation if something like that does happen?
So great question, Shireen. And just, I don't want to skip a step, which is today, not only is the pipeline being operated beyond the terms of its original lease, right? It's being operated in violation of its original 3 miles of easement agreements. But also where the Bad River is shifting her course it is today at profound risk of rupture. And that was presented at court. So ultimately, of course, the Bad River Band had to file suit.
Yes.
And experts for both sides effectively agreed that, and the judge, the lower court judge found that this pipeline could rupture with the next big flood to hit the Bad River Reservation. And that means within hours, as you know, this could be in Lake Superior. And the shutoff valves are 12 miles apart. So that is 540,000 barrels of oil that would head downstream right into Lake Superior. So the band has been very, very concerned about the state of the state. And I have to say, we asked Enbridge to sit for an interview. Mm-hmm. I am so grateful that Mike Fernandez, the chief communications officer, did sit for an interview. He is in our film.
Yes.
And he presents the Enbridge perspective on the entirety of the situation. And again, I very much appreciate that he took the time. He arrived, he was serious and thoughtful. But his perspective, which is that people are dependent upon oil, at the end of the day, the band's position is, this is not a story about oil. There are many, many, many ways to move oil. This is about a piece of infrastructure that is aging, it's about to fail, and it no longer has the right to operate. And those rights expired 10 years ago. And so the reason I think, you know, the former chairman, Mike Wiggins of the Bad River Band, said something really interesting. He said, you know, we are fighting so hard to protect Lake Superior. It is the freshwater stronghold for America. And I heard him a few weeks ago speak to the Bad River Band's just extraordinary effort. And he said, you know, this is our patriotic duty. This is, we are patriots by fighting so hard to protect this water source for Americans, because with increasing weather and extreme weather, more and more Americans in the lower 48 are going to be drawing on Lake Superior. And it is our duty to think beyond ourselves and fight for the country.
Do you feel like that message is getting across? Do you feel like people are hearing that and believing that?
Certainly before the film, there was very little national press on this issue. And I think since the film has emerged, there's just a lot more dialogue about the band, how they view their perspective on all of this. And again, the lower court judge was almost apoplectic that this pipeline could blow with the next, with the next major flood. And the band's position is, yeah, this was supposed to, you were supposed to restore the land to its original condition 10 years ago. You no longer have the right to operate. And Enbridge, you know, has a different position, of course. But you know, that's where the case is. As you may know, late last year, the lower court required Enbridge to shut down the pipeline. Mm-hmm. That's a stunning decision for a judge to actually require a shutdown of a pipeline. He postponed the shutdown for 3 years so that energy markets would be given a chance to settle. He heard all kinds of testimony on the economic impact of what a shutdown would do, and determined that over a three-year basis, there would be really modest business interruption for Enbridge. And Enbridge appealed this to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. Oral arguments were heard just a month ago. Mm-hmm. And there will likely be a decision over the next few months from the Seventh Circuit as to this shutdown and other matters that were raised during the course of the trial. So, you know, if I'm a betting person, I think that this goes all the way up to the Supreme Court.
So until this is decided by the court, there is no shutdown coming.
Well, unless the pipe bursts.
I've heard supporters of Line 5 say that this oil pipeline is necessary. What's your reaction to that?
the pipeline is not necessary. Oil is necessary because we're all addicted to it. But how you move oil, there are many, 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 many ways to move oil. And certainly the lower court found that there would be minimal disruption if you alter the flow, whether you go on exist other lines, whether you reroute and have a different, different pathway for this. But again, this is not a story about oil. We are a net exporter as a country of oil. We no longer have national security issues around oil. So as much as the talking points have focused on oil, this is simply not a story of oil. We have a lot of it. There are a lot of competitors. And I understand Enbridge will, this is a very, very profitable line, as you saw in court documents. And it's not surprising that this Canadian energy giant is fighting so hard to remain, to really keep in place such a profitable line. But the band is not concerned with profits. The band has turned down a settlement offer of $80 million to date. And again, their focus is on clean water, not just for themselves, but for generations to come and generations of Americans.
How do you see this film working to solve this problem or educate people in a way that they can understand one another better?
If you don't know the history of how hard the Bad River Band fought for its land when it had millions and millions and millions of acres, and now it has this little postage stamp, and what's left stands the, really they're fighting for the integrity of Lake Superior. And then you've got a company that, has very, very deep pockets to see its way through. But at the end of the day, this company signed an agreement and the terms expired. It's a good old-fashioned American contract. Any other tenant would have to, it's over. You have to leave. Mm-hmm. This is a company with very expensive lawyers, and its contract ran out. At the end of the day, you've got to honor what you sign.
It's always hard to tell what a court will do or when a court will do it. Do you have any sense as to how long this controversy and challenge will continue?
Honestly, I think this is likely headed for the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. I really do. I think, the Biden administration recently filed a brief in this case. It was an amicus brief and came out very strongly against Enbridge, called Enbridge a conscious trespasser with ill-gotten gains, recommended. It looked like they didn't specify what they thought the penalty was, but they called what the lower court had issued paltry. And on the other hand, Enbridge has triggered a pipeline treaty from the 1970s. This is 150 years later in time from the band's own treaty with the United States. And so the Biden administration has said, well, we think the judge should at least consider the relationship between the US and Canada in terms of fashioning timing of the shutdown, which is an equitable, remedy. And so anybody's guess for what this means or where it goes, but the idea that you can trigger a trade agreement or a treaty because you're dissatisfied with the outcome of a contract that you signed, that also sends that's a very, very dangerous precedent.
We are just about out of time. Where can people see the film? Where can they go to learn more about the film?
So if your viewers visit badriverfilm.com, we will be partnering with NBC Universal Xfinity, and the film will begin to stream in the very near future on Black Experience on Xfinity, Xfinity X1, and then later this fall, we will be streaming on Peacock.
Excellent.
All information will be at badriverfilm.com.
Thank you so much for sharing this and for the work that you did. It's a fascinating film, and I was grateful for the opportunity to watch it.
Thank you so much, Shireen.
You're listening to Route 51. I'm Shireen Seewert. Once more, extending a sincere thanks to our guest, Mary Mazzio. Ezra Wall and Joy Ratch Kramer assisted in producing this program, thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program and our previous programs at WPR.org/Route 51 and on your favorite podcast platform. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.